Hello, everyone. Welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European macro research at Natixis. And with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello, also from my side. So today we'd like to discuss about a controversial and politically charged topic, and that is industrial policy. So few economic policies generate stronger rejections from the bulk of economists than industrial policy measures. Recent intentions by the German government to subsidize electricity prices for heavy industry, for energy-intensive industry, for instance, are a case in point. There's been a chorus of rejections from economists. This said, industrial policy appears to be on the rise, and many governments seem to make extensive use of it. This is especially true for rich developed economies, which are using industrial policy more heavily than emerging markets, perhaps with some exceptions. In Europe, for instance, governments have recently used industrial policies to address the green transition, the resilience of supply chains, and increased geopolitical competition with China. And there seems to be somewhat of a reassessment of the effects of industrial policy underway, which has led to a more nuanced view of the effects of industrial policy measures. And we are here to discuss about this and the latest research findings with Nathan Lane from the University of Oxford, who is an expert in this field. So it's a pleasure to have you with us today, Nathan. Welcome to the podcast.
It's my pleasure as well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so in your work, you define industrial policies as government policies that explicitly target the transformation of the structure of economic activity in pursuit of some public goal, policy goal. Typically, this goal is broadly defined in terms of seeking to stimulate innovation, perhaps productivity, economic growth. What do we know about the key goals that governments seek to address with their industrial policy measures? In particular, how do they compare in the cross-section of countries and also over time? Do we see shifts, for instance?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. So broadly, we know that governments do industrial policy. Like, let's think of like kind of two broad goals. We can think of broad goals in terms of the definition we articulated here. You articulated nicely here. You know, indeed, we know that countries do a lot of industrial policy. They're doing things to actively try to shift the structure of economic activity, the structure and composition of what's being performed or done within an economy. And then if we kind of drill down and look at the type of market failures that are being targeted, or rather, the broader goals, we do know that there are some patterns, there are some trends. And I should also back up a bit, too, and say that there's not a lot of, I would say, holistic evidence and holistic data on what governments do in terms of industrial policy. Like, we have a paper on this. OECD does as well. Some other folks do, some think tanks in the U.S. But, like, I should also caveat what I'm about to say by saying we actually don't know a lot systematically about what governments are trying to target. But, you know, from the evidence we have and from the data we've collected, you can kind of see some broad emergent trends, such as, oh, indeed, there does seem to be a rise in the types of innovation or R&D type policies that a lot of G20 governments are pursuing. You do see that, for instance, some countries actually, there are broadly some similarities in the types of sectors, for instance, that governments try to target. Energy is like across the board, you see governments big and small, high income, low income, more or less, kind of targeting energy stuff, targeting kind of very strategic industries like steel, the metals, maybe some heavy machinery as well, electric machinery as well. So you do see like some of these commonalities that are kind of ubiquitous in users, among users of industrial policy. Likewise, you do see rising trends in just people doing this type of stuff. So rising trends in kind of the active interventions that governments are pursuing, or at least those that are visible to us as researchers, as people collecting this data.
So how strong of a trend is that?
Very strong. I'd say like there's been essentially an increasing trend since the global financial crisis. Like that's, you think of like kind of two trends going on, like, and then really a massive one since of course, the kind of elephant in there since COVID and the kind of realignment that's occurred in the post-COVID world. You do see even like a structural break in that trend where things get even stronger.
So you think this is connected to institutional change like WTO or
exactly? Or I do. I think it's contemporaneous with that. There's definitely a feedback loop with that. I think there's a growing mindfulness of governments wanting to strategically deal with some of the issues you articulated above, such as like resilience of supply chains, the kind of salience of politically and maybe physically of climate change issues, things like that. And of course, the big one is I think it would be fair to say, just as in a positive kind of observational sense, that the Biden administration's IRA and Big Chips Act really kind of kicked open the door globally for people to start having these discussions for responses and made these things actually something that the governments pretended like they didn't do en masse. It suddenly kind of made it, it opened up the conversation and made this less of a taboo, given that global leadership amongst the US. And of course, China too. China really led the way as well. So hopefully that answered your question.
So there's a lot of increase, as you said, in industrial policy interventions from governments. Mm-hmm. What would justify that increase? Or what's the economic rationale for a government doing industrial policy? What are trying to overcome here in terms of market failures?
Yeah. So this look at, you know, in our work, you could kind of simplify things to three classes of things that industrial policies are really trying to encounter. And these aren't kind of exotic. You know, these are things that are probably well known. You know, even kind of textbook Econ 101, neoclassical economics, that there's perhaps a rationale where there are externalities and market failures. So let's think of three broad classes. You can think of externalities, market failures, coordination failures, and probably something like we call it activity-specific public inputs. You know, broad horizontal inputs that are probably broadly needed by the industrial base to do stuff. Public infrastructural inputs of sorts. And so, I think among these, and the taxonomy can blur together. It's not a precise taxonomy. It's just a way of talking about what governments target. And broadly, you could say externalities being a really big one. Externalities and market failures are like a big one. The classic types of externalities, spillovers that we would see in textbook economics with the rationales for public interventions of all sorts.
Right. So that's quite interesting. Now, suppose a government were to correctly diagnose, say, a market failure or coordination failure in the economy, or maybe a deficiency in public input provision, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do we actually know that the government is in a position to overcome the failure it diagnosed? Or put differently, what would we have to assume regarding government behavior such that the diagnosis of a failure in the market actually justifies industrial policy in terms of improving the situation net of the side effects these policies can create in the political and the economic sphere?
Yes, that's a good point too. Political and economic sphere is like the kicker here. That's the key one, in that, you know, you could think of an informational problem first, which you kind of alluded to in that question, which is, right, does the government even have the informational capacity to locate these things, diagnose these things? Which, there's a big debate theoretically in economics as to whether that's the case. But you could think of like all sorts of policy that's done in like requires that type of information and knowledge of market failures and externalities. It's how especially environmental policy gets constructed, is using, it's how regulatory interventions are constructed. So there, I tend to think that the modern state does have, maybe not systematically, but maybe in piecemeal and maybe in vignettes and anecdotes, knowledge about big market failures for which they're trying to address. Of course, people can debate that. But secondly, is probably a more, even more important one, which is there really the political capacity or the political environment or bureaucratic environment even, but let's say political environment to it kind of implement something that is optimal, something that would actually overcome this without exacerbating it. That is, like, is industrial policy being set by a political bargain and a political process that could get us close to a solution that optimally encounters this kind of market failure? And of course, there often aren't the bodies pursuing industrial policy that do this technocratically, let's say. You know, like we've devolved technocratic policymaking in many cases. We know that macroeconomic policy bodies try to do this in a way that's depoliticized, you know, in quotes. That try to do this in ways that are relatively in your own fields of macroeconomics. We know that's essentially what central banks do. We hope that a political bargain process, for an amalgam of reasons, isn't what's informing an intervention, because often we have to do things that are maybe unpalatable, that can be captured by groups, that, you know, a macroeconomic policy outcome might be that emerges from a political process can be perhaps really far from an ideal, right? And when we think of the world of industrial policy and often fiscal policy too, what comes out of a political bargain can often be, or perhaps be, suboptimal sometimes, you know, because it's captured by a political process that might be highly flawed, highly imperfect, et cetera, et cetera.
So indicators? What would be indicators that we suffer less from these risks? I mean, say,
Yeah, just even institutionally, if there are bodies that kind of are accountable, that have partnership and buy-in from both stakeholders, you know, the private sector and the public sector in constructing these things, if there's a kind of somewhat of an independent body or somewhat of an independent bureaucratic capacity that kind of is in charge and at the helm, at the steering wheel, when it comes to deploying and crafting industrial policy, that's like an indicator probably par excellence, which some countries have who successfully do industrial policy and have legacies of doing it. But that's of course like a tall order, because many countries don't have that. You know, many countries don't have a development bank that's doing this tech, or one that isn't politically captured or wholly governed by all the kind of corrupt political stuff that can happen when policy is crafted. So I'd say it really, really varies drastically across the political environment beyond the kind of these parameters, which I referred to just now. I'd be hard pressed to find kind of like single anecdotes or single data types of data or characteristics, which would tell us, aha, oh, here's a government that's like, This is indicative of a government that's able to do this stuff very well. It'd be very case by case, and we don't know a lot, actually.
I mean, that leads to the next question, because ultimately we would like to understand whether industrial policy works and whether it has beneficial overall effects in practice. So measuring the success or failure of industrial policy is quite difficult. So for one, we need good empirical measures of the actions actually taken by governments and also of the outcomes that followed from that. And then one needs to assess what would have happened in the absence of the industrial policy measure, which is perhaps the most complicated task here. So can you tell us from your research what problems arise and how do you identify the causal effects of industrial policy? How address all these issues?
Yeah. No, these are the magic questions. And I'm going to back up a bit, maybe be a bit high level and pedantic by saying that and some of my answers to these questions might feel very high level, and they might seem like, oh, we don't know. Because as economists, we haven't been actively engaged in this area empirically and otherwise in ways that we should have been. I that's a hot take. But for me, economics has kind of abandoned formal study of this topic. So we're having to play catch up when it comes to both theory, but also importantly, when it comes to empirics and doing the empirical work that you just mentioned. Of course, we've made great strides in empirical economics in kind of doing policy evaluation. But a lot of these tools and a lot of our methods for doing policy evaluation and analyzing, well, what's the causal effect of a policy, you know, things like randomization, right? We want to kind of, we'll do an RCT. And of course, any macroeconomist will know, well, that's really hard to do in the aggregate. If that, that simply doesn't happen, we need different tools. And with industrial policy, even at the sectoral level, we have this issue that, well, we can't randomize policy because we often aren't worried about the random deployment of policy. We're not randomizing policy across sectors. We're hopefully choosing sectors for which, you know, that have a market failure, that have very specific characteristics, that are very much unlike other sectors, that might be those that are most kind of reactive and might be those most beneficially responsive to a policy intervention. And of course, that belies, that kind of like negates the idea of randomization writ large, which a lot of our policy evaluation tools are about randomizing stuff. And so you really have to kind of take this middle ground almost between macro and micro econometrics and try to kind of use some new estimation methods and be clever in trying to estimate these counterfactuals and trying to estimate the causal effect of policies, which can get rather tricky, but there are kind of now econometric tools that allow us to do so. Of course, I think a lot of us think that in order to look at the aggregate effects of policies, we might be very good, we might be pretty good now, I think, at identifying what's the causal effect of a policy on the growth of an industry, on different industrial outcomes, but how those things trickle up and kind of aggregate and whether they are conducive to aggregate growth, we of course need kind of more heavy duty machinery. And I think we kind of need what us as economists call structural models in order to kind of make sense of, well, what are the aggregate effects of these disaggregated policies? So I hope that I'm not getting too wonky here. I don't know whether this is the right scope. But that's to say, I think we still have a lot of work to do there. But when it comes to analyzing kind of first pass issues or detecting moments that we think indicate that industrial policy is working, we have no agreed upon nomenclature for thinking about, okay, we always will look at TFP. We always will look at output growth. We always will look at output. We're often using an amalgam of different policy or different policy outcomes. We're often caring about an amalgam of different policy outcomes, but we're pretty good at that now. But we usually have to be much more kind of multidimensional than a lot of policy evaluation tools and a lot of policy evaluation frameworks use. But the caveat, I think, where we know least is in how do we aggregate these? How do we kind of think about the macroeconomic effects of these policies? That's where we have most work to do.
Right. So given, you know, how little we know, would you say that the strong negative judgment on industrial policy that's actually out there in the profession is not really justified? Or would you say there, you know, this is probably correct, but we still don't know, but or do we have indications and where things work well in terms of industrial policy and sectors perhaps, or circumstances in which do we know anything systematic, or is there just this verdict out there that has no empirical basis? I mean,
yeah, so it's a bit tricky. I think the skepticism is warranted, right? I think the skepticism is coming from a good impulse within economics and that good kind of economic skepticism. I think that's right. But whether it's empirically informed, that's a whole other question. And I think like this, our skepticism around industrial policy, I think emerged before the empirical turn in economics. And it wasn't empirically informed. Of course, it's informed by major anecdotes, major failures. Of course, on the other side, the proponents, you know, it's informed by successes, salient successes that people advocate. You know, think people often talk about the East Asian growth miracle as kind of rationale in cases where maybe countries, technocrats, and folks got industrial policy right. But of course, a lot of that, none of this discussion for or against is coming from hard quantitative empirical evidence that us as economists would find satisfying. These are really contingent upon anecdotes. And so I'd say that our skepticism, the outright negative view of industrial policies is ill-informed and not really helpful. And what I mean by that is like industrial policy can just be a lot of stuff. It's a huge class of policies. A lot of things can be used to change the structure of an economy. To say that any intervention that does so is a failure, I think, is is a real tall empirical order. Like that's a hard thing to defend empirically. And so I think that's not a helpful discussion that economists have when people take this very binary view of industrial policy. It should be very context specific. And in certain contexts, we have some emerging evidence in which contexts industrial policies fail or don't. But really, I'd say the empirical evidence is so thin relative to kind of the ubiquity of its use around the globe that that it's hard to make broad sweeping claims about industrial policy. And even in the kind of sectors that we target, we know that there's a lot of failures in steel. We know there's a lot of successes in steel. We need more work. And it's another one of these cases that the answers are kind of unsatisfying, you know, because the literature is so thin, because we're just now playing catch up empirically.
Can you nevertheless mention a few clear, obvious success examples where you'd say, okay, that proves it can work, where you would say that is clearly the context was right, the policy was right, and it worked. Sure. We can obviously easily come up with failures. That's not so difficult. Yes. But where can we specifically say, okay, here it worked?
Yeah, well-known cases and well-known kind of micro cases of industrial policy working. We can think of a lot of policies arising from, and a lot of the technologies and outcomes arising from, let's say some U.S.-based initiatives like DARPA. You know, those are kind of canonical studies of like, okay, these are surgical instruments that seem to have good outcomes when it comes to promoting technological change in very specific contexts. Of course, like in some big cases, I think some even within the East Asian miracle, I'm a bit hesitant to say, hey, East Asian miracle par excellence is an example of stuff working because it's so heterogeneous itself. But within the East Asian growth miracle, I'd say the export booms, the export pushes that governments pursue there are kind of some pretty good, like say, South Korea, 1962 to 1973, I think is like, it would be hard to argue that wasn't industrial policy. It would be hard to land in Korea and be like, hey, I'm an American economist. I don't think this was industrial policy. That would just be unbelievable to people because it just seems so clear that was a case where there was an export push that seemed to work and seemed to construct the foundations for industrialization in the first place. We can argue whether that's replicable or not. But I'd say like there are some proof of concepts you could point to. Okay, these are industrial policies working. Things like some of the technological innovations that arose from the Green Revolution, in particular, the adoption of some mechanical machinery around the Green Revolution and their dissemination in the Philippines and Southeast Asia in the mid-1960s are another kind of a great kind of like clear-cut example of like this is public funding for industrial policy working and having large global aggregate effects.
Right, that's very interesting. So thanks for reminding of the possibility that certain things can actually work. That's sure, very sure. good, I think, and very valuable. So now one other issue with industrial policy seems to be that, you know, governments really don't act in isolation. Often
yes.
industrial policies arise also in response to industrial policy actions taken by other governments in other countries. This is, of course, now a big discussion in Europe. The United States has passed the Inflation Reduction Act. It incentivizes European companies to invest heavily in the green sector in the US, and this may actually crowd out investment in Europe. And Europe is thinking about whether it has to respond with similar subsidies just to prevent that from happening. So in the end, if countries are in sort of engaged in this sort of strategic game, they may end up in a sort of a dilemma situation where, you know, one country subsidizes and responds, other countries subsidize. And then we are in the end in a world where we're no better off than without subsidies, because subsidies need to be financed by taxes, and taxes, we know, are more often than not distortionary. So in Europe, we sort of had this situation and we tried to solve it by delegating to the Common Market Authority, to Brussels, mm-hmm. to the European level. And we had something similar at the world level, at least until a few years ago with the WTO, yeah. which sought to prevent exactly this sort of bad equilibrium outcome where everyone is engaged in export promoting activities. But currently the WTO is really in a very weak position. And this seems to be breaking down now around the globe. So in general, can we say when and under what circumstances a country should need to take into account the policy actions of other countries? You know, what is the best response, or what is the best strategy in this world where we can't rely anymore on an institutional setup to prevent a subsidy race, say?
Yeah, these are, I'd say, like the magic questions right now. And again, a kind of like an area where as economists, we kind of have pie on our face and that we don't have clear answers. Well, I mean, in fairness, it's a complicated question. Right. But I wish we had better things to say about it. There is some really good work on this. But I think what has happened right now is really interesting because you're having to see multilateral institutions essentially evolve and try to figure out how to work with this new paradigm that we're operating in. This new paradigm being that we're not in a world where we can ignore industrial policy or pretend it doesn't exist, or will it away by multilateral agreements. There's obviously people, actors, working in contradiction to that old order, which sought to kind of diminish these at all costs or pretend they didn't exist, or manage them in a very tight way. And of course, the WTO is in no position to do that. And I'd say we do probably need, and what even the U.S. recognizes this, you could see it in their policy language, that there needs to be some global coordination with this, because there is exactly kind of this issue that we do think that there might be a subsidies race that could be massively distortionary and might be socially suboptimal globally. But that's to say, too, that coordination isn't feasible or necessary. I think even amongst industrial policy levers, even without a body that's like a global body that's coordinating things, there still needs to be coordination, like bilateral coordination. For instance, like you see that the US industrial policy, there's no way they could onshore or reshore everything in their supply chain. So even within green industrial policy within the US, they are having to account for not other actors who might strategically respond, right? But they are having to respond to other countries and incorporate other countries in that decision, because there for sure has to be other actors in the supply chain who are willing to cooperate with them in order to kind of nearshore, friendshore, move things back to a supply chain for them that is manageable. So that's to say, even without global coordination, that you see actors already having to incorporate and deal with other countries, because we're working in a world that's so intertwined where things can't possibly be fully autarkic and fully move to kind of one country pursuing industrial policy domestically. You're going to have other actors involved.
But that could be very one-sided, that coordination. I mean, if the 100%. US says, we take from you what we really need, what we cannot onshore, yes. But the rest, we put a big tariff on it. I mean, how should Europe, just to name an example, respond yes. to that? Is not being cooperative a good strategy until there is some cooperation enforced because of that behavior?
I think that's exactly right. And so this isn't to say that that's optimal, but it's to say that there is a necessity for coordination no matter what. And I think the WTO and multilateral organizations need to evolve and are evolving right now. Those few of us working on industrial policy are working, without naming names, with them to try to think through these issues. And I think there are some models to try to kind of accommodate industrial policy in this kind of new world. Even people point to even levers within the WTO. You can think of the Agreement on Agriculture, AOA, within the WTO, the kind of agricultural body or the body within the WTO or the rules within the WTO that manage, and the EU has something similar too, that try to manage and kind of arbitrate the use of agricultural subsidies, for which there are exceptions in the international landscape for doing what was kind of what's called agricultural policy, but it is industrial policy in miniature for a specific sector, which tries to look at and tries to be careful in distinguishing between agricultural subsidies that are welfare reducing for people, or that might in fact be so pressing and overcome very large market failures such that, you know, these things are probably required, even if they are distortionary. They might deal with social welfare implications that are so pressing that the WTO does allow them to exist and does accommodate them. Or importantly, I think distinguishes between subsidies that are damaging versus those that seemingly aren't too damaging versus those that are actually welfare improving. So that's to say, I think we need a body that kind of accommodates the nuances of policy and is able to kind of look at industrial policy in a much more nuanced way. I think we do have some models institutionally on how this could work, but your point is completely right. And there has to be some global coordination, I think, in some way, such as to make this optimal and such as to make this also fair in the world. Because we also see that the industrial policy is like the big actors can use it. They have the state capacity, the political capacity, they have the global social, the global political capital and economic capital to do these things. What about the small players? And so I think that type of fairness is also something that has to be accounted for in this process by whatever institutional regime emerges out of this process. And we really don't know what's going to emerge. Like, we really don't. And so it's kind of a scary place when it comes to industrial policy making right now, because it's where I think we have very few answers. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to emerge. But I think everyone would agree there has to be some global coordination in order to avert the very scenario that you're talking about.
Okay. Well, for the time being, it looks more like an arms race, but we shall see.
Yes, we shall see.
Yeah.
We shall see.
Let me try to summarize what you've said. So what is it that governments want to achieve? Well, very generally speaking, they try to shift the structure of the economy, but immediately said, there's a lot of uncertainty what they in the end want to achieve because it's just difficult to pin down, though often it's targeting very specific sectors. What's the economic rationale for industrial policy action? Well, classical ones, i.e. externalities, spillover, coordination failure, but also you mentioned that providing public infrastructure inputs. Then obviously the question, why could governments overcome that such a market failure? And you said that, in your view, governments do have some understanding if there is indeed a big market failure, and you pointed to central banks as a bureaucratic, technocratic institution that to some extent also intervenes and is also not as politicized as one could think when it comes to specific subsidies. So as a way or as a possible solution to that problem, if you will. How to measure the success of IP, so industrial policy, you said there's some methodological progress, what is measurable and how to identify the causalities, but also admitted there's still a lot of work to do, it's still very complex, not least because we don't have any randomized experiments. Does it work? You pointed to DARPA in the US, but also South Korea as examples where it'd be hard-pressed not to say that some of these success in the economic development of South Korea is explainable with industrial policy, but very context-specific in the end, the question whether it works or not. And finally, how should others respond if industrial policy is used in other countries and made a strong case that obviously global coordination would be preferable, and you can think of ways how to make the existing institutions adapt to the new environment, but we're not there yet, and in the meantime we're in the wilderness. It seems. Was that a fair summary?
I think that's very fair. And I think it's fair to say that no matter what, the conversation amongst economists is usually, should we do this or not, which is an inadequate conversation to be having, because it doesn't take into account the realities of an environment where people are doing this. And so I think we really need more research on how to do this more technocratically, both globally in coordinated ways, but also just in so far as the technocratic basics of implementing this stuff. We know so little.
So more work for you.
Yeah, thank you. Endless. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your time today, Nathan. It was a pleasure.
It's fantastic. Thank you so much.